This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming, like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you need is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 143 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
I'm good, man. How about you?
I'm doing great.
That's good.
Is it good?
It's always good if you're
it's
doing
good that I'm doing great.
Yeah.
You ever notice how you say you're doing good, and I say I'm doing great?
I noticed that.
I'm a one-upper.
You always are.
I feel bad about that.
No, you don't. You did it with the chairs. You do it with...
Don't start with the chair.
With headphones, microphone, everything.
You've gone a long time not talking about the chairs, the microphone, the equipment.
Yeah.
It's literally a carbon copy.
I also notice on the t-shirts, the Team Gibby ones and the Team Fergie ones, I notice that your lettering is a size bigger.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did that on purpose.
I know. I'm just saying.
What you are forgetting is that we put out a weekly video on Patreon.
Yeah.
And people can see the whole studio.
Well, I mean, we're doing it on green screen. I don't know what you put me in.
Yeah, because we got that kind of money.
That's right.
To do green screen.
Green screen.
All right, buddy. We have some new Patreon supporters.
All right.
So let's go ahead and give our shout outs. We had Maria De Aramo.
Ooh, De Aramo.
Tyler Lamp.
What's going on? Lighten it up, Lamp.
Cody.
Hey, Cody.
Megan Perry.
Hey, thanks, Megan Perry.
Sarah. Richard McCorkle.
What's going on, McCorkle?
Stephanie Barnett.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Chloe.
What's going on, Chloe?
Jen Waterman.
Hey, Jen.
Katie Uhl.
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 Oh.
Or Yule.
Yule?
Yule.
Yule?
I don't know.
Hey, Katie.
Hi, Katie. Stacy Kittredge.
Hey, Stacy.
Angela Hensley.
Hey, Angela.
Amanda Rodriguez.
Hey, thank you, Rodriguez.
Stephanie Meir.
Hey, Stephanie.
Ashley Scateri.
Ooh, Scateri.
Maddie Gaspar.
Madagascar.
It sounds like it. It's Maddie Gaspar.
I'm going to go with Madagascar.
Kurt Johnson.
Hey, Kurt.
Diana Laverick.
Hey, Diana.
Paige Stollard.
Hey, Paige.
Christina Spade.
What's going on, Christina?
Camilla Havda.
Hey, Havda.
Hallie.
Hey, Hallie.
Tristan Copier.
Ooh, Tristan. Tristan?
Tristan.
Or Tristan. Or
have you ever heard of somebody named Christian?
A few.
No, I don't think you have.
Yeah.
I think you've heard of a lot of Christian, and then you're transposing or whatever you call it.
Maybe I am.
What's it to you?
Yeah, what's it to you?
Stephanie Brudow.
Hey, Stephanie.
And Jasmine Savage.
Hey, Jasmine.
So we appreciate all that new support. And then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs. This week we selected Drama Llama Dava.
Drama, what's up?
We didn't know what it meant back then. We still don't know what it means. Except for the fact that they've been supporting us for a very long time. And we appreciate it.
We do appreciate it.
We had some PayPal support as well. We had Chelsea Camp.
Hey, Chelsea.
Tamara Moore.
Hey, Tamara.
Daisy Davies.
Hey, Daisy.
And Heather Allen.
Thank you, Heather.
So big thanks there.
Absolutely.
So Gibbs, we talked about this on TCAT, but might as well talk about it here. There might be some people that listen Unsolved that don't listen to the regular TCAT. the reviews are in. You and I this past week made the decision that we were going to shut it down.
Yeah.
We did it for 4 months, maybe a little over.
We did.
And it just never gained the type of traction. First of all, it didn't start out the way we had hoped. And then it never really gained traction.
Yeah.
And so it was a hard decision. Number one, because you and I love doing it. We have a lot of fun. We kind of crack up and can be lighthearted. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, we looked at it and said, if it's never going to go anywhere, then that time that we're spending on putting, you know, those episodes out could be better spent on something else that will actually reach more people or that more people are interested in.
I mean, the bad part about not continuing it is that I made a commitment to get a tattoo on me that said the reviews are in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to do a word every month. And so, but I started late, so we're stopping it, but I've only got now on my lower back says the reviews.
Mm.
That's what, so now for the rest of my life on my lower back, it just says the reviews.
Well, I guess it's better than going the other way and it just says RN.
Well, that's true too.
Right above your back. Because that would have been even worse.
Yeah. I mean, I'm stuck with that, but you know, we'll work with it.
So you can make it your own now. It doesn't have to say the reviews are in. It can say the reviews are positive.
I don't know.
Whatever you want.
I'm sure I'll come up with something.
But we wanted to let everybody know that right now we have an episode out on True Crime All the Time. It's on a man named George Wallace, George Kent Wallace.
Yeah, we want to clarify who we're doing.
Not to be confused with some other famous George Wallaces. This was a bad guy. And he targeted younger boys. I mean, some men, some like 18-year-olds, but a lot of these were younger boys. He had a fetish, Gibbs, of wanting to paddle boys. I don't know how else to put it. They called him the Mad Paddler. He spent a lot of time in prison. He was in and out of prison for essentially most of his adult life. But the thing is, he kept getting out.
Yeah.
And every time he would get out, he would go and do the same thing. Impersonate a police officer, grab some kid that he shouldn't and paddle them.
Yeah.
Until he eventually graduated to murder. And so it's one of those cases where, you know, at the end of it, people are going to be saying, why did they keep letting this guy out time and time again? Why wasn't there some gatekeeper looking back at this guy's history and saying, you know what? Maybe not this time.
This is probably where the justice system kind of let everybody down.
Yeah. I think we have to draw the line at some point. But that's out there. Make sure you go and check that out. We also got our link for CrimeCon.
Yeah.
CrimeCon is coming up. It'll be here before you know it. It's next May in Orlando. It's going to be a lot of fun. They all have been a blast. We'd love to see as many people as can come out. So they gave us our code. It's TCATT20, TCATT20. So use that to purchase your badges for CrimeCon. If you've already purchased them, feel free to call in and tell them that code and they'll make it retroactive. We very much appreciate it.
Definitely do it.
All right, Gibbs, are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All Time Unsolved?
I'm ready.
We are talking about the 1984 unsolved murder of Matthew Margulies. 13-year-old Matthew Margulies was an eighth grader at Western Junior High School. His parents, Paul and Marianne, had just divorced in 1983, and his dad moved away to Texas. So Matthew lived with his mother and his older sister, Stacy, in the neighborhood of Pemberwick. This is in the city of Greenwich, Connecticut. And Greenwich is one of those cities, right? There's a lot of money.
There is.
In Greenwich. But where they lived was a little bit more modest part of the city. This was a part full of hardworking, middle class, middle income families.
Yeah, this had the smaller style homes, you know.
Yeah, this weren't the fancy multi-million dollar houses.
Right.
The neighborhood that they lived in had a river that flowed through it. It was called the Byram River. And Matthew loved to fish. This wasn't a big river, right? It's a little shallow river. but he loved to fish it. He was out there all the time. He knew every part of the river because he had spent so much time on it fishing, a lot of that with his grandfather.
I think a lot of us learned to fish with our grandparents. I learned with my grandpa.
Yeah, I have great memories of my grandfather taking me fishing. Now, this wasn't river fishing. When I was growing up, my grandparents lived in Florida. So we would go visit them at least once a year. Sometimes if we had the money, a couple of times a year, he would take me to the pier.
Oh.
And, you know, we'd use those great big rods and he'd get some bait from the bait shop. I remember I caught like a stingray one time. And I was like, okay, I don't know what to do with this. And he took it off.
Yeah, that pier fishing is fun, man.
Yeah. Now, on my other side, my mother's side, my grandparents, and we've talked about it, lived down by Knoxville.
Right.
So we would go to Norris Lake quite a bit.
Yeah.
Now, that was lake fishing, and that's more of what I'm used to today.
Yeah, catch you some bass and crappie. And
love it.
Yeah, good times.
I actually like to fish a lot.
Well, you got the whole setup.
I do.
You got the outfit, the poles, the tackle, the whole shebang.
Isn't that what you need if you're going to go fishing?
Yeah.
What do you have, a pocket fisherman from Ronco?
I actually do. Do you? Just for those rare occasions that I pass along a place, I'm like, I wish I had my... Oh, wait a minute. I do. I got my Ronco right here in my pocket.
But back to Matthew's love of fishing. I mean, this is something that family and friends talked about. This is 1983, 1984. So, yes, there are video games out there, but it's not like it is today, right? Not everybody has a PlayStation, Xbox. This kid was out at the river every day catching fish. He wasn't using his virtual avatar to, I don't know, do whatever you do in some of those games.
Yeah. Look, my avatar caught a fish today.
Yeah.
How exciting is
that? He wasn't fishing on the PlayStation. He was fishing in real life.
There is a certain thrill you get when you hook a fish.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what keeps people coming back to fishing because, let's face it, there are times where it can be very boring.
Oh, yeah.
But when you hook a big fish, there is that adrenaline rush, and it's kind of what keeps you coming back. Yeah. Now, on Thursday night, August 30th, 1984, Matthew and his sister spent the night with their grandma. His grandfather that we talked about had passed away just a few weeks prior to this. And Matthew's mother was a nurse, and she had to work a double shift that night in a Stamford nursing home to pick up some extra cash.
Well, single mom, you're going to do what you have to.
Have to.
Yeah. And nurses work hard. I mean, I know your mom's a nurse and, you know, a double shift. That's a lot of hours on your feet, man.
And for a while, my mom was a single mom.
Yeah.
Working as a nurse. So, you know, two of the things that I have the most respect for.
Yeah.
Single moms and nurses.
Yeah, you do.
Because that's what, you know, I grew up with that. On Friday, August 31st, Matthew woke up at his grandma's house. He got dressed. He grabbed his fishing pole. He grabbed his tackle. And he took off fishing that morning. He was fishing for trout on the river. And apparently, he caught a very nice trout. Because around noon, he went back to his grandma's house and he dropped off the fish to her to have her cook it up. They were going to eat it later.
Yeah, well, good old trout, you know.
Good old trout.
Good old trout, man.
That's your contribution.
Good old trout.
You know?
Smoke it, fry it, whatever you want to do with it.
This is not a cooking show, by the way. So he dropped off this fish, Gibbs, and decided that he needed to change clothes. That's something you often have to do when you're done fishing. That's the one drawback to fishing. It's not a scent-free sport.
No, and you're going to get wet. You're going to get muddy, and you kind of like to put some dry stuff on.
Yeah, and sometimes it gets odorous, for sure. So he got some dry clothes on, headed back out for the day. He was wearing a t-shirt, shorts, socks, and a pair of black and white checker slip-on sneakers. Almost sounds like maybe like a pair of Vans.
Kind of, don't they?
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So. I remember back from about that time frame, those were very popular.
Yeah, skateboarders. Now, and
they might not have been the brand Vans, but maybe they were, or they at least looked like them.
Right.
Now, of course, he took his fishing pole with him because it sounds like he didn't go too many places without this fishing pole. Like you and your pocket fisherman, he never knew when he was going to have the opportunity to catch a fish.
When an opportunity strikes, you got to take advantage.
So he walked through town that day and was seen by a number of people. I mean, this is a kid carrying a fishing pole and tackle. That's probably going to stand out later on.
Yeah, people are going to be like, hey, there's Matthew.
Yep. It's probably not going to be hard to remember that you saw him. So there were some key times and some key witnesses as it relates to this day. Around 5 p.m., there were some people that said they saw Matthew about a block from a popular deli in town called Sparta Deli. This was on the corner of Comley and Morgan Avenues. So people remember seeing him around the deli, but nobody actually remembered seeing him go inside the deli.
Well, and I think that's because it was a hangout for a lot of the older teenagers that were kind of known as troublemakers or bullies. And he knew that he needed to avoid that.
So you're saying you, if you lived in this town, you would have probably been out in front of the Sparta Deli.
With a big old turkey sandwich in my hand.
Wearing an Adidas tracksuit.
Wearing an Adidas tracksuit. That's right.
But you're right. This kid's only 13 years old. Now, maybe not you, but I think back to when I was 13 years old. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was get too close to a bunch of 16, 17, 18-year-old kids all grouped together. Didn't matter what you were doing. Something bad was bound to happen.
It flashes me back to that movie with Matthew McConaughey and all those young actors.
Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused, man, when they go chasing them around in their cars, yeah, trying to pull them over to get them with a paddle.
It was the times.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I have talked about bullying a lot, and it just, you know, as a young kid, you stayed clear of certain situations, and that was one of them.
Yeah. Avoid things if you could.
Yeah. Now, sometime around 5:30 p.m. on Nicholas Avenue, and this is just down from Comley Avenue, a teenage girl riding in a car later reported that she saw Matthew walking down the street. She waved to him and he waved back to her. Essentially, Gibbs, this was the last time anyone saw Matthew Margulies alive.
Yeah. That teenage girl was the last one.
And it was around this exact same time that this teenage girl saw Matthew that his mother got to his grandmother's house to pick him up. But of course, we know Matthew's not there. His mother, Mary Ann, figured that, okay, he's a 13-year-old boy. He's running a little bit late. He's walking home. He got distracted. Whatever. I'll wait for him here. His sister, Stacy, was at a doctor's appointment at this time that her grandmother had driven her to. It was really about 6 p.m. that Mary Ann started to get concerned because Matthew still had not shown up. That's one thing to be 5 minutes late, maybe right, 10 minutes late. You're starting to get into half hour or more. People start to worry.
Yeah, especially with no phone call.
And there's no phone call. And like we've talked about before, much tougher to get a hold of somebody, to track somebody down. No cell phones, nothing like that.
Yeah, today you would just open that app up. I know you have it and you say,
I do.
There's my kid right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, call or not, I know where you are.
Right. I open it up on you a lot. Says you're at the massage parlor. I don't know. I don't ask questions.
I lower back injury. It's just,
I know you got a bad back. It's a football injury.
Yeah.
Marching band. I mean, I call it football, but it's same carrying thing. The tuba.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. They help out, though.
But in all seriousness, this is where panic starts to set in. And every parent listening to this knows what we're talking about.
Yep.
It can be 10, 15, 20 minutes. It starts to set in very quickly. And I don't know about you, Gibbs, but I have a bad habit of thinking bad thoughts, like very quickly, like probably more quickly than I should.
Go worst case scenario.
Yeah. I often go, maybe not worst case scenario, but darker than I should go.
Yeah.
It was just a week or two ago, my daughter did not get off the bus. And I started freaking out, trying to call my wife. And she said, yeah, I told you last night she had to stay at school for whatever. But again, she doesn't get off the bus and I'm thinking it's a catastrophe.
Yeah. You've already got weapons loaded up.
Sure.
You've got, you know.
My bug out bag.
Yeah.
But Marianne was starting to panic. And I think one of the reasons that she did was because of the type of kid that Matthew was. He wasn't the type to not call home. You know, he was a good kid. If he said he was going to be somewhere, he would be there.
Yeah.
And if for some reason he wasn't able to meet that, he would call. Stop at a payphone probably and call her.
And she had to be freaking out, especially when Stacy got back home with the, you know, the grandma, and neither one of them knew anything about where Matthew was. I mean, at that point, you got to start asking yourself, where could he possibly be?
So Marianne started calling his friends. She called some people around town, anyone she could think of, to see if they had seen him or knew where he was. And she didn't wait long. It was about 7 p.m. when she called the police to report that Matthew had not returned home from, you know, being out fishing. And she relayed to police that she had talked to a number of his friends. Nobody knew where he was. And I think to heighten the level of panic, some of the friends that Marianne talked to said that they had plans to meet up with Matthew in the late afternoon to go fishing, but they informed her that he never came. He never made it.
And that right there, knowing that he was a pretty punctual guy, I mean, it's alarming because here he is. He's missed time with his friends and he's missed being at grandma's house on time to be picked up by his mom. I don't know. I would be really worried.
Yeah. The reason why I think the worry level goes up exponentially is because in the beginning, you think he's missed the deadline to come home or the time that he's supposed to be home. That's one thing. Then when you find out that, okay, he missed something, let's say hours earlier, and his friends never saw him, that is much more alarming. So the police came by. They asked Marianne some questions. They also talked to local family and friends. They decided to search the river, and they got some help from the fire department. There was also some local volunteers who pitched in. And I think it made sense, right? This is a kid that spent a lot of his time at the river. So the thought was, let's comb this river. Maybe he's just fishing and he went farther than he normally does, or
yeah,
you know, lost track of time, whatever it was, or maybe had some type of problem on the river, twisted an ankle, broke a leg, whatever. Maybe Gibbs, he'd fallen into the river and hurt himself that way.
It could happen.
There's a lot of things that can happen.
They also searched the cemetery where his grandpa was buried just a couple weeks ago, because again, this was somebody he was really close with, and maybe he just wanted to get away and go up there and sit with grandpa for a little bit, you know, and kind of reflect. But they went up there. They couldn't find them.
Yeah, I don't even know if we emphasized how close they were. I mean, I think Matthew's grandfather was like his best friend. Here's the problem. They searched for hours. No sign of Matthew. And eventually it got too dark. So they had to put the search on hold. Then on Saturday morning, with still no signs of Matthew, the police called his dad in Texas to let him know what was going on. But they also asked him, had he seen Matthew? Had he heard from Matthew? And he said, no, neither. So they renewed their search efforts that morning. As the morning went on, state police came in. They got on site with search dogs. They searched the woods, the river, and some other surrounding areas. Volunteers pretty quickly started putting flyers up all over town. But as that day went on, and I think this happens in every case, some despair starts to set in. right? The worry starts to grow that we could have something on our hands here that is more than just a boy that's gone. I'm going to use the word missing, right, as in we don't know where he is.
Right.
The worry now becomes foul play. Someone has done something they shouldn't have done.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the professionals, the police, the firefighters, probably in their back of their mind, they're now thinking maybe we're turning this into more of a recovery.
Yeah, I don't know at what point that would happen. It could happen that quickly. It might take a little bit longer. I agree, professionals, it's probably going to creep into their into the back of their mind much quicker, probably, than the family. The family's not going to want to think that at all.
No.
But the truth of the matter is, we're talking about a 13-year-old boy, and not the type of boy that is going to run away, right? Willing. So I guess what I'm getting at is, from most people's point of view, he's not staying away willingly. That's not the type of kid that he is.
Well, you're exactly right. He had a good household.
Yes.
He liked being with his mom, his older sister, his grandma.
Right. He's not disgruntled. No. And has a history of running away. And so I think you have to factor all of that in. The FBI was called in on the search that night. And then on Sunday morning, they had a helicopter searching from the sky. So now you have a bunch of different agencies, right? Local police, state police, FBI. There's a combination of divers from different agencies in the river, in some of the local ponds. They also began dragging the river in some of the deeper areas. Because again, you have to cover all bases.
Yeah.
You know, like you mentioned, you're not hoping that you're at the point where you're looking for a body, but you have to go and take some of those steps, and dragging the river would be one of them.
Yeah, you want to be able to eliminate.
Exactly. Now, we said it was a shallow river, but I think it had some spots that were deeper.
Yeah.
Where you would have to drag it to know for sure.
Right.
The next morning, Monday morning, a psychic told Stacy that Matthew's body would be found on a nearby steep hill by an unknown male.
Well, that's a pretty clear statement.
It is. And I wish we had more information about the psychic. We don't know who contacted who. We just know that there was a conversation between the two of them, and this is what was said. On the same day, Marianne searched up near some steep and rocky parts of the river. These are areas where she had previously told Matthew he was not allowed to go. A little bit more dangerous part of the river. She didn't see anything, but she did tell police that there was a really foul odor up there. Now, she described it as if an animal or animals had died. The police knew this was a place where a lot of local fishermen clean their fish. That's kind of a smelly proposition.
Yeah.
They assumed that was the smell. They didn't pursue it any further. The problem I have with that is I've cleaned a lot of fish.
Yeah.
To me, there's a big difference between a fishy smell and the smell of a rotting carcass or the smell of death.
Absolutely.
There's a huge difference.
Yeah.
To me.
I think their mistake was thinking she might not know the difference. Just assume that it has to be fish.
Yes. But isn't that the problem? A lot of times when you assume,
yeah,
it doesn't go well.
No, it does not.
It was on September 5th, 1984, that a local volunteer fireman, guy's name was Fred Lambert, he decided to search for Matthew by trying to get into his head. He was basically trying to figure out what path Matthew would have taken to get home from the last place where he was known to have been seen. Pretty smart.
Yeah.
Seems like a good idea. So he headed down a steep, wooded, rocky hill between two roads. And as he's walking down this path, he starts to smell this really strong odor. that he knows is the smell of death. Now, he thinks, okay, it could be a dead animal,
right,
or multiple animals. But then he saw a gym shoe. It was a black and white checkered shoe, which he knew was the description of the shoes that Matthew was last known to be wearing. That's really all he saw. But I think Gibbs, in the back of his mind, he thought, this could be a crime scene.
Yeah, I need to back off.
Yep. He did not want to disturb a single thing. So what he did was he marked the location so that he could easily find it later or lead police to it. And he went off to get the police. So a couple of officers arrive at the scene to investigate what this guy found. He walks them into the woods over to this rocky area where he saw the shoe. And I guess, Gibbs, they saw what was a massive amount of flies, thousands maybe, swarming over a pile of leaves, rocks, and tree limbs. And as they walked closer, they saw an ear sticking out from underneath this pile, and they saw some toes. And it was the body of Matthew Margulies that was buried under all of this debris. So now the recovery team gets there. They begin to uncover the body. They see that Matthew is wearing only his underwear, and he has a sock on one foot. Someone had taken his t-shirt and wrapped it around his neck and twisted it extremely tight.
Yep.
But it gets worse.
Oh, man. It does.
Whoever killed Matthew took dirt and, along with gravel and sticks, and basically forced all of this down his throat. And then on top of that, shoved his other sock into his mouth.
As if to
seal it up, yeah, or keep it from coming out, yeah, almost.
So he wouldn't be able to scream.
Then this monster of a killer, because I don't know whatever the word you could use, this was a monster, cut Matthew's throat. And later on, they're going to be able to tell. You know, the medical examiner can tell from the tremendous amount of defensive wounds on Matthew that he really fought. He tried to fight off his killer.
Yeah.
The killer also stabbed him several times in the torso. So Gibbs, brutal. Yeah. Absolutely brutal.
Awful.
Next to the body, authorities found a 10-inch boning knife. They also found his shorts and his shoes.
It's rough, man.
Oh, you know, it's very rough to think about a 13-year-old boy of any age, a kid of any age.
Yeah.
You know, boy, girl, to think about them being all alone and dying that way in such a brutal fashion. Yeah. It just, you know, tears you up. It breaks your heart. I talked about the medical examiner. So this was a guy by the name of Dr. Carver who performed the autopsy. He determined that Matthew's cause of death was from the stab wounds as well as the asphyxiation. The coroner did report that there was no sexual assault. The coroner was able to collect some good evidence. There was a hair from an unknown individual, as well as some fingernail scrapings from Matthew. That's good stuff.
Yeah, hopefully something they could use down the road
to catch his killer. But then you talk about the family being informed. Horrible.
Yeah.
That's something I would never want to have to do.
And not only just to find out that your child's dead, but find out how he died.
Yeah, the way that he died. Yeah. And as you can expect, they were devastated. On top of that, the entire community was in shock that this would happen to anyone, let alone a 13-year-old boy.
Yeah. Now you're out there wondering, where's this killer at?
Yeah. There's a killer out there somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, is he still in our town? Is he one of our town's people?
Yes.
There's a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah.
To be asked, and those are scary thoughts. Not to mention the fact that the community of Greenwich was still trying to move on from the 1975 brutal murder of 15-year-old Martha Moxley. And Gibbs, this is a case that, and you know it, has fascinated me for a long time. We haven't covered it yet, but it's coming. Martha was beaten with a golf club, stabbed in the throat with the broken shaft of the golf club. And, you know, that it's a case that is technically unsolved, although a lot of people believe they know who did it.
Sure.
Now, in 1984, when this was happening, when this was going on, when Matthew was murdered,
yeah,
they had no idea.
No. I don't think it was till 2002 till they started.
Yeah, but we'll get into that when we when we cover that case. So that's a lot for one community.
Yeah, when the 9 years, two teenagers murdered, nobody knows who did it. It's going to change how things are done in that town.
And it did, right? And you and I talk about this in a lot of older cases. You know, a lot of these communities were places where people didn't lock their front doors, didn't lock their car doors. And then something happens to change all of that. You lose that Mayberry feeling.
Oh, you sure do.
When kids are killed in your town.
Yeah.
You didn't see that on Mayberry.
No.
Right? Andy is not investigating the death of a 13-year-old boy that I remember.
I'm not investigating any deaths.
I remember, you know, he's just eating pie. He's just eating Aunt B's pie.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
Well, now you're going to
have... And going fishing with Opie. That was
Opie, that's right. So now you're going to have kids coming home from school. Instead of playing outside, they're going to be going right home, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of things that have to change in the wake of, you know, these types of tragedies. Kids that used to just go out and wander, you know, through the trails, through the woods and the parks, they're not going to be able to do that anymore.
No, their parents are saying, I want you home. You're going to be home where I can keep my eye on you.
All right, Gibbs. So now let's look into the investigation of Matthew's murder. Like very quickly, the FBI got their behavioral science unit involved with this case to assist with developing a profile of the killer. Now, this is pretty early on.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody that has watched Mindhunter knows it started in, what, the late 70s?
Yeah.
So this is still pretty early in the development of the behavioral sciences unit and FBI profiling in general. But you did have John Douglas, who is probably one of the most famous psychological profilers.
I would say so.
And the basis for Mindhunter. One of them. He said that he believed the killer was a white male who was familiar with Matthew. And not only that, he was familiar with his routine, especially his fishing routine, which, like we mentioned, that was a big part of his routine.
Right.
Fishing. Douglas said that this person could be overweight, may have a drinking problem or maybe even a drug problem. He said this person would have what he called a loser mentality, right? I would probably euphemistically call it low self-esteem.
Right.
It's a little bit nicer way to say it. But we're also talking about a killer, so do we really care?
Yeah, we don't.
Do we need to be nice to this killer? No. I don't think so.
I agree.
Might very well have some body image issues. Now, we mentioned that there was no sexual assault, but Greenwich authorities thought that there was something to this murder that was sexual in nature. They thought maybe that lust somehow was involved.
Yeah, I think when you get into the strangulation, you know, making the victim pull their pants down or you pull their pants down, you know, it borders that, I think.
Sure. No, I can see why that is. If you're going to kill someone, there really is no need to take off their clothes.
No.
I could see, you know, taking off the shirt because you use that to strangle, let's say. But why would you take off somebody's shorts? There's no reason for that. And I could see why somebody would view that as possibly being related to some type of sexual activity,
yeah,
even though there was no sexual assault. So police are looking for leads, are looking for suspects. They talked to a lady who lived across the river from the murder site, and she told police that she heard some very disturbing screams around 6, maybe 6:30, the night that Matthew went missing. Another witness said that he recalled driving past Matthew sometime between 5:30 and 6 and seeing another boy walking behind him that appeared older. This boy had black hair. He described the boy as dumpy looking and said that he had just got out of a green Chevy. Now, he also said this place where he saw Matthew when he drove by was just below the spot of the murder. And this guy must have been pretty close to home because he told police that he was home around 6 o'clock and he thought he heard the screams of a boy.
So it makes you wonder, did they hear Matthew? And maybe that explains why the killer started shoving things down Matthew's throat.
In an attempt to keep him from screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the police looked into several suspects. One of these suspects was known as the local teenage bully. And this kid just happened to live very close. I mean, pretty much right next to the area where Matthew's body was found. This kid also had a history of bullying and threatening Matthew in the past. Now, it wasn't just Matthew. He had a history of bullying and threatening a lot of other kids as well. But Matthew was one of those kids. There were reports that this boy had pulled a knife very similar to the one found by Matthew's body on one of Matthew's friends, and he threatened to cut him with it. Gibbs, it was also reported that this teenager, just a month before Matthew was killed, tricked another boy into following him into a vacant apartment unit. He threw this boy on the ground and he stabbed him in the back with a nail multiple times and tried to take his pants off.
Strange.
It's strange. It's horrifying. It's not good.
Right.
But I think the act of taking the boy's pants off, that probably had to send the alarm bells ringing.
Spark some interest for sure.
Given the fact that Matthew's shorts were off.
Yeah.
Now, you couple that with the fact that he stabbed this boy. Now, he stabbed him with a nail, but still, it's a vicious act.
Yeah.
And it probably would have gone further had a resident not walked in and stopped this boy. Now, the teenager, the bully said, hey, we're just playing around. This is all fun and games. But it wasn't.
No, I mean, you got a kid there bleeding from several nail punctures to his back.
And he pretty quickly went to police and said, hey, this boy attacked me. So it was obviously not horsing around that got out of control. It's a little murky as to what happened with this teenager in relation to this incident with this boy. Something happened, but couldn't quite figure out all the details. It definitely put him on police radar. But here's the problem. Police did their investigation and they were able to verify that this teenager had an alibi. The day that Matthew was killed, he was working at the local Wendy's and he had a time card and witnesses to back him up.
Yeah. I think his time card showed that he clocked in at 4:30 and clocked out at 10:40 PM. So, you know, I mean, look, I had buddies that worked at fast food when they were supposed to be working, they were hanging out with me. So,
yeah, I was just going to say, not to really tell on myself, but in the old days where you had a manual time clock with a card, right? It would stamp it.
Yeah.
It wasn't unusual for somebody else to stamp your card.
Oh, all the time.
If you were running late or if you left early, you would just say, hey, stamp me at this time.
Yeah. I'll get you next time.
And I'll get your back. I don't know, maybe you and I are sharing too much of what we did, but I think that was pretty common. We're not going to be the only ones who would have done that.
I think that's why they got away from those type of systems.
But if it's all real, it definitely would put him outside of the time ranges that we've talked about, right? We know Matthew was last seen around, 5:30, 6-ish?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that time frame. Some of these people said they heard screams at around 6. That's when the murder is thought to have occurred.
Yeah, I mean,
based on the screams, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they go off the teenage girl seeing him last at 5:30. I know the one man said he saw Matthew between 5:30 and 6, but I don't know how much credibility that has with the police department.
But I don't know. I mean, if she says 5:30 and he says 5:30 to 6, they're not that far off.
No, not really. I mean,
it's not like he said I saw him at 8 or between 8 and 9. So.
Yeah.
And then you have multiple people saying that they heard screams around 6 to 6:30. So I think, Gibbs, they liked this bully at first until his seemingly solid alibi.
Sure.
We'll have to assume it's solid. Kind of prove that it couldn't have been him.
Right.
At least in the eyes of the police, they kind of went away from him.
But like I say, every time we look into these cases, maybe he's not the guy that did this, but still not a great person.
Oh, no.
You know, here's another bad individual.
He's puncturing a kid in the back with nails.
Who knows? I don't know from 1984 to now what happened to this kid, what he turned into, but...
Man, that's a whole nother podcast.
That is.
We should track down some of these people and see what they're doing now.
Where are they now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of them would be locked up.
So police continued their investigation. They had over 12, 13, 14 detectives working this case. This had to have been a high profile case, right? We're talking about Greenwich, Connecticut.
Yeah.
Parts of which are extremely affluent. Nobody in that town wants a murderer running around on the loose.
No, and you just came off the heels 9 years ago of Martha Moxley.
So that would have stirred up a lot of old feelings.
Sure.
No doubt.
And the need to get this solved. You don't want to have another crime solved.
I think that's the key, right? That being unsolved at the time, that puts extra pressure on the police to solve this one. We haven't been able to solve the other one. That was high profile. Now we have this one. We have to solve this one. You know, at times it was reported that they had up to 8 solid leads that they were working. Now, I mentioned that this was a town that, you know, had some affluent people. It was also a town that had some bizarre people living there. And you touched on it. We see it all the time.
Yeah.
When we research these cases. And I say this, you never know truly what's going on with your neighbor, your coworker. Man, they seem great on the outside. You just never know what kind of deep, dark secrets they're hiding, what they do behind their closed door. You just don't know. I think the police felt that the killer had to be local based on the fact that they thought, okay, he had to have some knowledge of the murder site. Matthew is thought to have been killed within an hour or so, maybe even less, of when he was last seen. So logically, you think, okay, whoever killed him had to have known. Where can I take him where nobody's going to spot me?
Yeah. Where's a good location to get in and out unseen?
And you and I talk about this quite a bit. That's much easier if you're from the area and you know all the little places.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that a stranger can't stumble and find a place, but it is much easier if you know where you're going.
And most locals would say where he was found was not something that you would have typically stumbled upon.
Yeah. I mean, I think we said it, right? It was a place where the local fishermen went to gut their or clean their fish. Probably not a place where a tourist is just going to wander and find, or an out-of-town killer. One report that police checked out was about a 30-something-year-old man who attempted to sexually attack a teenage boy who was exercising down by the river. So this was an attempted attack, but the victim got away and reported it to police. The police looked into another case where a teenager said he was sexually assaulted. Earlier that year, while he was fishing, he said a man attacked him, tied him up, sexually assaulted him, and told him that he'd come back and kill him if he told anyone. The problem is the victim could not identify his attacker. He didn't know what he looked like, and police had some issues with the story. They found some holes in it. Police also looked into another teenager who was known to harass and bully other kids down at the river. He had done this in the past with Matthew. They found that out. But every time police tried to talk to this person, he evaded them. And when they were able to confront him, this guy's father would not allow police to talk to his son without him being present. So the father set up a meeting for he and his son to come in and talk with investigators, but they never showed. And there really isn't anything else out there, Gibbs, about this suspect. No, I don't know what police did or if they did anything to follow up. There's just no documentation.
Yeah. Just kind of ends right there.
Now, one thing you know police are going to do, they are going to look into all known child molesters in and around the area. And they did that, but apparently they all checked out. So police have looked into a lot of different leads, but nothing has panned out. And at a certain point, the case went cold. And then, you know, Gibbs, you just have no leads to follow. You have nothing else to chase down. And police were left with another unsolved murder of a teenager and a community that's not happy about it. Of course, the police aren't happy about it either. They want to solve it.
Well, sure. But the community, and this is 2 in 9 years, and no answers.
And when you research this case, you see a lot of information, a lot of people talking about shoddy police work.
Yeah.
That the police didn't do everything they could do. You see that in both of the cases of Matthew Margulies.
Yeah.
And Martha Moxley. Do you realize both of those start with M too, by the way?
Did not realize that, but both of them are MM.
It just hit me that both of their names start with M.
Yeah.
But you do. There's a lot of that online and even in print. I mean, editorials about how some people just don't feel that the police did everything they could do. You do have that in a lot of unsolved cases.
You do. Though. And it's easy to quarterback.
It is.
From the sidelines, you know.
Monday morning quarterback.
Yeah, it really
is. You just said it's easy to quarterback. It's really not. It's very hard
to be a quarterback. Yeah, yeah. But I get it. Frustration. And when you're frustrated and you don't get the answers that you were hoping for, what else are you going to turn to? You're going to turn to the people who are doing the job and say, maybe they're not doing a good job.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people that say, hey, I pay my taxes. This is what I expect you to do.
Right.
The problem with police work, it's not like, you know, filling out a report at your job. For the most part, there wasn't anything preventing me from filling out a report at my job. Mm-hmm. I'm just using that as an example.
Right.
Solving a murder case is not always cut and dry. It's just not always that easy.
And sometimes what you work on today might not bring you what you need until later, right? I mean, you're stirring up stuff.
Sure.
You know, you're trying to stir up some leads and you have to investigate those all the way through. Sometimes they're not going to be rapid.
And you can look at a lot of the cases, cold cases that were unsolved for 20, 30 years that have been solved lately. And why have they been solved? A lot of these. Because the technology advanced to the point where some police work done 30 years ago and something collected can now be analyzed, right? They didn't have it. The sample wasn't good enough, even when DNA came about. But now the technology is there and it can be. So, again, I don't know if the police did a good job or not. I think it's important to point out that there are a lot of people that do not feel as though they did. But I think you have that in every case.
I do. I think especially
because it's unsolved.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't help them that they have two major unsolved cases.
Yes.
Right. And just from the research that I did, I know that 2 years after this, they have another unsolved case. And it's wrapped around an infant. But you know, that's for another time.
It couldn't have made them look good either.
No.
Now, police have always been quick to point out that this is not a cold case. It will always remain active. There were some interesting developments that occurred in 2004. A man was arrested and sentenced for child molestation in Texas. The man's name was Roger Bates, and he was a retired Port Chester, New York police officer who had moved to Texas. His victim was only 14 years old. Bates was convicted and sentenced to 22 years in prison. When this news came out, and again, this is 2004, a local boy from Port Chester said that he too had been sexually assaulted by Bates back in 1984. The young man said that back then he was a fishing buddy of Matthew Margulies. So Gibbs, this is a man now in his 30s, looking back and saying, hey, this man sexually molested me. There's a good chance that maybe he was connected with Matthew's murder. Because the two boys had a connection. They were fishing buddies. And at one time, this guy Bates took both boys to his favorite fishing spot. And the three of them fished there several times. So there you can make a link not only between Bates and his known victim, or this kid that said he was a victim, but you can make a connection between Bates and Matthew Margulies.
Yeah.
Through what this man now says.
That's a good lead.
It's a very good lead. So police wanted to follow that lead. And they went through the process to obtain Bates' DNA, but they hit a roadblock when it came back that it was not a match from anything collected at the crime scene. Police also couldn't put Bates near the crime scene on the day that the murder occurred. It didn't stop them, though. They made several attempts to put this before a grand jury.
Yeah, they did.
But it didn't go any farther than that. The grand jury looked at the evidence and said, hey, you don't have enough to move forward. In 2007, police thought they had another suspect. They did DNA testing again. But again, it came back not a match.
Just roadblock after roadblock, you know? But again, it's interesting.
It's interesting because you have DNA.
Yeah.
And you have the technology now to take what was recovered from the crime scene, extract DNA from it,
yeah,
and use it to match against these people. The problem is it's proving that it wasn't them.
No.
Or at least it's proving that their DNA wasn't there.
I mean, clearly they've done something bad in their past to get on the radar.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Especially this Bates guy.
Yeah.
Matthew's mom, Marianne, is still very optimistic that someday Matthew's killer will be found, arrested, tried, and convicted for what he did. I'm using the word he. I'm assuming this is a man, and I normally do.
Yeah.
Based on the cases that we do, the family attorney made a statement to the press that said, the family is pleased that the matter remains an open investigation. We are optimistic that at some point in time, the person or persons who committed this crime will be identified and arrested. On the bridge that Matthew would take most days to get to the river, there's a plaque now that says Matthew Margulies, an excellent angler, and now with God, 1971 to 1984. It's a tough case, Gibbs.
It's a tough case.
You know, the age of the victim always makes it tough. It's a case where the police have had a lot of challenges. It seems like they ran through all the leads that they had. There have been a couple new leads that have come in, but they've run those down and came up dry. There doesn't seem to be a lot lately in the way of leads or new evidence or anything like that. It's typical of an unsolved case of this age. I won't call it a cold case because they're saying it's not cold.
Right.
But I think you have that with a lot of these older unsolved cases. It's not like the police are sitting around getting new tips and leads every day. I mean, this case is what, 35 years old?
Yeah.
It's going to take something special. It's going to take a break. It's going to take somebody deciding that it's time for them to get something off their chest.
Yeah.
Or it's going to take a DNA match. Those are the two things that I'm kind of looking at to help solve this case. And either one could happen.
It could.
It's not outside of the realm of possibility at all. But the police need some help.
Yeah.
They definitely do. They need someone to come forward. Or like I said, they need some type of DNA hit. The state of Connecticut currently has about 1,000 unsolved murder cases.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think every state has a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know the numbers across the United States, but there are far too many unsolved murder cases. We know that. And like you said, there are cold cases or older unsolved cases where I think some of the newer technology could maybe break some of these cases open.
Right.
But yet it takes time and it takes money to do all the lab work and the processing.
Yeah.
And it hasn't all been done. Can't all be done at the same time.
And the thing about these unsolved cases, you would say, well, they should be able to do a lot of podcasts on those. But they're unsolved, which means that the police are not letting all the information out there because we talked about it.
Sure.
There's reasons why they don't put everything out there.
Yeah, a solved case is much easier to put together in podcast form. Number one, you have a lot more information.
Sure.
Because it came out at trial. It's probably in a court document somewhere.
Yeah.
It's of public record. If we knew everything that the police knew, we could do a bunch of great unsolved podcasts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But they, like you said, they got to hold a lot of that back because
they're kind of picky about.
Yeah. And they probably have some great suspects that they never talk about. And they probably have these ties to these suspects that would be great to tell an audience about, but they haven't released the information.
Yeah.
But that's it. That's the case of the murder of Matthew Margulies. It's one that I'd love to see solved. I want them all solved, but
yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is one where I don't want to be talking about it in 30 years and saying Mary Ann passed away, never finding out what happened to her son. I don't want to be saying that.
Right.
I don't want that to happen. I mean, she's already lived 35 years. Number one, without her son, but number two, without knowing what happened and without having somebody pay for what they did.
Yeah.
It's tough, man.
It is tough.
It's going to be very tough on her. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Yes, here.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. This is Ophelia calling from Sacramento, California. I started listening to you guys early August, and I finally caught up, and I'm finished, and I was very sad that there was no other episode to continue my marathon that I've been having for the last couple of months. Well, thank you guys. Keep the good job going. I'm not Team Mike or Team Gibby. I'm Team T-Cat. Thank you, and keep your on-time ticket.
All right, Gib. She's probably talking about T-Cat. I don't know, but maybe she'll jump over and listen to Unsolved.
Yeah. If she runs out of both of them, she can jump over, I guess, and listen to your criminology.
All right. Well, we have, 16 Patreon episodes. Check those out.
Check those out, too.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
I was really excited today on the Patreon episode to hear my birthday mentioned. And then you said that's when he decided to commit the murder. So I kind of felt a little bit like Charlie Brown when Lucy pulled the football away. Anyway, great episode. A lot of fun. Happy Thanksgiving from Dispatcher Lisa. Bye.
Dispatcher Lisa always leaves the best voicemail.
She does.
So, super excited. We're talking about her birthday, and then boom.
Yeah.
Is when the killer decided to commit his murder. Yeah. That's rough.
It is. But hey, we still mentioned your birthday.
We did.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Gibby. I've been listening. Well, first off, my name's Hannah Akari, and I'm from Rochester, New York. But I've been listening since August, and I've already gone through all of your episodes already. But I just wanted to call and let you guys know you guys are doing a great job, and I'd love to meet you guys one day. But right now, I'm a poor college student, so I can't really support the show or anything like that. But I've been listening, and you guys have been improved over the years. Keep your own time ticking. Bye.
Well, we appreciate that. Hope you're doing well in college. I also have a poor college student.
Yeah, you do.
And my family.
Yeah.
My daughter. So we love people that can support the show on Patreon, PayPal. We talk about that.
Yeah.
But that's not the only way to support the show. That's financial support, and that's great.
Right.
It helps us keep the things moving. But just listening to the podcast is supporting the show.
Yeah.
And then the higher our download numbers are,
yep,
the better the chance that we're going to get some advertising, which helps us out. I would also say, people telling their friends and word of mouth, that is a free way to support the show.
Put it out on social media.
Yeah, or talking about it on social media. It's all great. It doesn't have to be financial.
Grab your friend's phone and put us on there.
That's the way Gibby does.
Yeah.
He just grabs strangers' phones. Hey, can you put your password in? Because I really need to get to the podcast app, that's but right. I don't know your password.
Yeah. Once we get it downloaded, it's good from there.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. My name is Allison. I am actually from Indiana. My sister lives in Dayton currently, so a little bit of connection there, I guess. But I currently live in Charleston, and after completely binging your podcast and through it now and just waiting eagerly for the next episode, I just decided to take a look and quickly Google Charleston serial killers, and Samuel Little came up, and I had never heard his name before. He's apparently only been convicted of 3 murders, but the FBI is saying he is the most prolific serial killer in American history. He's suspected of killing at least 90 people, and he's actually started to draw his victims, which I thought was fascinating. But I love your guys' podcast. I'm completely hooked. I'm actually right now watching I Am a Killer on Netflix, which just keeps making me think that you guys should do every single one of these. But I know you only have so much time in a day. So anyway, I just wanted to say hi and thanks for what you're doing. And keep your own time ticking.
All right. That was probably meant for TCAT too, but there's only so many voicemails. I have to put some on unsolved.
Right.
So Samuel Little, pretty well known at this point in time. You and I have talked about doing him. I guess the reason why I hold off is because I feel like there's still more to the story.
Yeah, it's not done yet.
And I feel like doing it right now would be jumping the gun a little bit.
Because
I feel like there's more to come out. And I want to tell the whole story.
And he does have a little bit of Henry Lee Lucas in him as far as they keep attaching or he keeps attaching more things to him. And just like Henry Lee Lucas did drawings of his victims, he's doing drawings of his victims as well. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting for sure.
He's a very interesting study.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it. I just feel like we need to wait a little bit. I want to have the complete, I don't know if you'll ever have the complete picture, but I want to have as much of it as we can.
Yeah, I agree.
So, all right, we appreciate all the voicemails and we appreciate everyone listening. That's it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.